Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. On the line with us is Patrick Hedger. Patrick is currently the Vice President of Policy at the Taxpayer Protection Alliance. Prior to that, he was a research fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute's Center for Technology and Innovation, and also served as the Director of Policy at the Koch Brothers Freedom Works. And protectingtaxpayers.org is his current website. Pat Hedger 18, P-A-T Hedger, H-E-D-G-E-R 1-8 is his Twitter handle. And Patrick, welcome back to the program. It's been a while since we've talked. You published this piece in the Dispatch titled J.D. Vance. This is the guy who wrote Hillbilly Elegy and has now become kind of a political guy. Shows how the populist right adopted the logic of you didn't build that. Give me a summary of the position that you're taking in this, Patrick.
Yeah, absolutely. It's sort of pointing out that there is a creeping authoritarianism that's occurring on the right, and I find it very concerning. It was in response to comments that J.D. Vance made on Tucker Carlson's program, and he was asked, you know, what do you say to the arguments that Google is a private company, and, you know, Google is a stand-in for Silicon Valley and other major firms broadly, and J.D. Vance said, well, I just don't care. And that just shows just such a flagrant disregard for the Constitution and how our government works. And for somebody that is all but a declared candidate for the U.S. Senate as a Republican from Ohio to say that you don't care about how the Bill of Rights works, I don't see how you can swear an oath upon the Constitution and serve in office with that kind of mindset.
What am I missing here, Patrick? My understanding is that the First Amendment says that the government may not inhibit freedom of speech, except under, you know, obvious conditions like you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. I mean, it doesn't say that in the First Amendment, but that's how it's been interpreted by the courts over the years. But it doesn't say that you or I have an absolute right, that if you or I own a corporation, like, you know, if you owned Google or you have some little Google equivalent and you start censoring people or not displaying their posts, you haven't violated the Constitution. You're a private business. Google's a private business. Why should we worry?
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, it's nice to agree with you on some things here. That's the issue. They are trying to claim that Google or Facebook or any other media company has to host this kind of speech. And really, the laws that we have on the books right now, something like Section 230 and the First Amendment, is what protects the ability of Google through YouTube to make sure they don't have any pornography on their platform, to make sure it's for the most part, a family-friendly place. Same with Facebook. I mean, and it allows that sort of experimentation between platforms to compete, right? You can find indecent content on Twitter, but you're going to have a harder time finding it on Facebook or a harder time finding it on YouTube. And again, that's these platforms exercising their First Amendment rights. If you're putting up Nazi propaganda on YouTube, they're well within their rights to take it down. And those are their rights, not just of speech, but of freedom of association. If they don't want to be associated with your content, they shouldn't have to be. And if you don't want to have me on your show, you don't have to have me on your show. I think if we erode the rights of the big corporations to have freedom of association, that weakens the rights that protect journalists and all of us and all of our freedom of speech.
So we're talking with Patrick Hedger, Vice President of Policy at Taxpayers Protection Alliance. If you're concerned about right-wingers being essentially censored, you know, Trump was censored off Twitter, others being censored off YouTube, and I get that, then what's your solution to this? I'll tell you right up front. Mine is, I think that all of these companies should be basically no longer operating as monopolies. They should be broken up, particularly those companies that have acquired other parts, you know, Facebook acquiring Instagram, for example, YouTube being acquired by Google, that each one of these operations, at the very least, should be a standalone company that just does what they do. And I've got over 100 years of antitrust legislation and enforcement to back me up on that. I mean, back in the 50s, Brown Shoes and there was another shoe company. These two shoe companies were forbidden by the Supreme Court from merging because the merger would have controlled 6% of the market for shoes in the United States. Right now, Nike has 19% of that market. So we have really abandoned this. Isn't antitrust legislation, which then promotes participation of a free enterprise participation and opens up marketplaces. You know, after AT&T was broken up into 7 or 9 regional companies plus Bell Labs, Lucian Technologies, it not only massively increased shareholder value, it kicked off a huge wave of innovation across the United States as these companies started competing with each other, these former Bell companies. Isn't that the solution?
Oh, there's a lot I could address there, but to kind of stay focused on the First Amendment aspects, I get concerned about using antitrust as a political weapon. And that's what you see a lot of folks.
What's political
on the
about
right
this?
Are trying to. Well, they're concerned that Google is exercising its First Amendment rights and that warrants Google being broken up. I would rather antitrust stay narrowly focused on promoting competition and ensuring consumer welfare.
But that's my point. If you broke up Google enough that people could get into that space and compete. And what I'm talking about is not saying Google has to divide into 16 different search engine companies, but what are they doing in the operating system business, for example? If you broke them up into all these separate companies, you would diminish the power that they have in any one company to use the synergy of all those other companies to maintain market dominance. I mean, part of YouTube's market dominance is the result of Google sending everything to it, right? The search engine part of it.
But the theater will kick you out, sure.
Okay, we'll leave you with the last word. Patrick Hedger, the website protectingtaxpayers.org, Patrick Hedger 18 on Twitter. Thank you, Patrick.
Hey, thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be right back. Fascinating how the right just doesn't quite know how to deal with this. What do we do about police use of force? The police officer who killed Mr. Wright recently has now resigned. Where is that going to go? What do we do about this? How do we reimagine policing in the United States? How do we reinvent this? You had Army Lieutenant Karan Nazario, you know, the second lieutenant, who was pulled over by the Windsor Police Department and beaten up. And then we've got, it's like step after step after step. How can we look at this and not say something is fundamentally wrong here? And I realize I've been saying that for the 18 years I've been doing this program. And, you know, many Americans have been saying it for a hell of a lot longer than that. But it's time for some solutions. It's time to do something. And I think that, frankly, the George Floyd, Justice in Policing Act is a great place to start. Anyhow, picking up your phone calls and thoughts on this, David in Palatine, Illinois. Hey, David, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. What I think is that the everyday police officer shouldn't have guns issued. Only a very select few police officers that really need to go into a situation should be armed.
Which is how they used to do it in the UK, you know?
Right. And the reason is because when these police officers make a stop and it's involved with an African-American, a black man, for whatever reason, well, it's probably racism, the situation just escalates immediately. And their odds of surviving it, the black person's, is pretty diminished. And so they're given no benefit of the doubt. So I just think one way to protect them is just remove the gun from the officer. And that would hopefully solve some of these killings.
You know, when you consider the reality, and it is a reality, that most police officers in their entire career never discharge their weapon. The idea that every single cop has to have a gun does start to seem kind of weird. And, I realize it's gun culture in America and everything else. But, David, I think that your suggestion is brilliant and something that, we should be thinking of very carefully. In fact, we need to change the whole culture around guns in America back to what it was like. When I was a kid, I remember it in, Cub Scouts and Boy Scouts, the NRA coming in and doing training for us. I had a BB gun. My friends had we went hunting with their parents. We all understood the first thing was this is a weapon. It's designed to kill things, including people. It's not a toy. It's you respect this, and that whole shtick. And like right now it's like, you've got members of Congress posing in front of 15 weapons on the wall behind them, and they think it's some kind of macho thing, like making up for their sexual inadequacies or something. It's just totally bizarre the direction we've gone with this. And our police departments, ever since Reagan's 1099 program, where the military takes any old leftover stuff they've got and hands it off to the cops every year so that they can order more stuff to keep their budget cranked. And of course, this all works out to the benefit of the defense contractors who get to sell more stuff. I mean, it's like the perfect storm of crazy. Joan in Rochester, Minnesota. Hey, Joan, this is all happening right in your backyard. What are your thoughts?
Yes, it is, and that's a little scary. Well, the policemen have been faced with a big dilemma. They were formed to help the people in this country, and we all relied on that. And then early in 2000, I absolutely saw a video where the military was in a Minneapolis police station training police. Now, what choice did the police have at that time? Keep their jobs and absorb the military training, or leave because they couldn't do for the people what they had done before. And so what it's caused is a belief that they had no choices, and so the people had started to look at the police in a different way because they were acting in a different way to the people. And another thing I think is a problem for the police is I think that some of these hate groups have infiltrated and become police officers and might be responsible for some of the deaths of the black people. But I wish the police all the good luck in getting back to how they used to be, because I know that was what was in their heart. And I think the militarization, and like you said just a little while ago, the dumping of the stuff into the police hands by the military in this country has done a big disservice to everybody. They need to keep themselves out of our local business and get back to the business of protecting our country.
I think, though, Joan, that there's another and perhaps larger issue that is almost never discussed, and that is, where did policing in America come from? If you go back to England at the time of the American Revolution, they had laws in place. They were called maximum wage laws, that an employer could not pay people over a certain amount because they did not want a middle class to emerge. They viewed the middle class as a threat. They felt that there had to be a permanent underclass, and that underclass was necessary for the overclass, for the wealthy, the lords, ladies, and the royal families, to be as rich as they were. And so the purpose of the police, one of the major purposes of the police in England at that time, was to police this lower class. In other words, to keep them in their place. And I think that we adopted an awful lot of that in the United States during that period of time in the 1700s, 1600s, 1700s, 1800s. And that to this day, a large chunk of the job that police officers are asked to do is basically keep people in their place, keep people down, when they protest the fact that society has structured itself in a way that establishes that as their place.
Now, did the police there, were they armed? Or were they like they are now, they're an unarmed
force? You mean in England in the 1700s?
Yes,
I honestly don't know the answer to the question.
Yeah,
I doubt that they were armed with what you would call a gun, because those were hard to use,
right,
and slow and expensive. But they certainly were armed with billy clubs. I mean, those stories are legendary. Dickens tells them in at least one of his books. And Dickens really knew. I mean, he was 100 years later, but he absolutely knew what it was like in England at that time and why. So, Joan, excellent points all. Bobby in Fort Mills, South Carolina, says you're an ex-cop?
I am, Tom.
And a decorated FBI, a federal agent, and a training officer. So what are your thoughts on this shooting near Minneapolis?
Just cannot buy it. I mean, I'm familiar with firearms, and the weight alone of the weapon she carried, a Glock and the taser, it's just no way that you can mix up the two unless you just didn't care. Now, as I understand it, officers today wear the taser on the weak side, but it's reversed, where you have to cross your arm to pull it. Of course, her strong arm is pulling that Glock. And when you pull that Glock, the first thing you see when you point it are two white dots on the sight. And she said, taser. Well, she was pointing that gun. The weight alone should have told her. I think she pulled that
gun. Yeah, plus you'd see that the gun is dark. You know, it's typically black metal, and the taser's bright yellow plastic.
And the lady you spoke with, she was dead on. This I just cannot believe it. And her length of time as a police officer, you just don't make mistakes like that. You just don't. You know, I've met in recruiting, I've talked to a lot of young people in my day, and if they talk, like one man said, well, I asked him if the man took a ham and ran away, would you shoot him? He said, yes, I would shoot him. I asked the question three times, would you shoot a man running away with a ham? The reason why I asked him that is because this particular Christmas, it happened where I live. The guy stole a ham on Christmas Eve. They ran away, and the security guard shot him in the back. So I'm just saying, I just don't buy her story.
What's a life worth?
And I've recruited.
Yeah, what's a life worth in America?
Yeah, I just can't buy her story. You know, when I was an agent, supervisors would call you in every 30 days and talk with you about what you're doing. They would talk to your partners to find out what your mindset is, how you've been talking, and this and that, because some of my work was covert, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm.
And so they need to know what your mindset was. And let me tell you something else, and I'll let you go. I've talked to many a cop. I walk into a 7-Eleven. I see them drinking coffee. I say hello to them. They act like they're scared to death to even speak to me. I am African-American, you know. But they act like...
Just because you're black, you mean?
You, and in my... Well, no, I don't think it's that. I think because...
Or are you talking about walking in uniform?
No, they're in uniform. I'm walking in as a civilian.
And you're not.
But my point, Tom, is...
Right.
My point is this. In my day, we walked a beat. We got a chance to know the people. Cops in cars today do not have any interaction with the average citizen. They live in their scout cars. They talk to each other. And that's part of the problem. They don't even get out of the car to even engage an individual. And when they do, it's like cowboy heaven. It's like with the lieutenant.
Yeah.
That should not have happened, Bob.
Yeah, so I totally get it, Bobby, and I'm with you. You know, a couple of years ago when we were talking about community policing, we had Officer Katie on the program, who's a Seattle cop who just walks a beat. That's all she does. I don't know if she still is, but it was such a refreshing, you know, you get to know the people. Bobby, thank you. Thank you for the call, and thanks for sharing your expertise experience with us. Thank you. It's honored and appreciated.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Susie in Torrance, California. Hey, Susie, what's up?
Hi, yeah, and part of that situational awareness is also understanding the community that you're policing and understanding the fear level of somebody being pulled over and her just coming from the back without any... or enough interaction to understand why he might be frightened and run, that sense of not being listened to. I know I was assaulted by Redondo PD. What was I doing? Walking my 13-pound service dog.
Wow.
On a Saturday afternoon. And I had said to the cop that the person who likely called, and I called it right, had dementia and didn't remember an incident. I wanted her to to testify to, which was lies by a toxic manager in a HUD building for disabled and seniors. And she was hard of hearing. But also I wanted to call you out, too, on talking about the South, because I've been threatened by Klan, actually, in Connecticut in the 80s and in the Hamptons in the 90s.
Oh, you're right, Susan.
Our trademark
white supremacy is not unique to the South. You're absolutely right. And Tucker Carlson is not. I mean, you know, Susie, thank you. I'm sorry, we're out of time.
Visit TomHartmann.com for audio and video archives.
Although the South did raise it to essentially the level of a religion for 100 years, and the lost cause lives on.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
You're listening to Tom Hartmann.
James in Chicago. Hey, James, what's on your mind?
I got 2 points I want to make, Tom. Number one, along with what you and the callers were saying about the police officer, that officer has over 20 years experience. And initially, she was about 8 feet away from the other two officers. Now, I'm going to tell you what I think. Now, I don't want to say that she was doing an execution type thing, but I think that with this Floyd Chauvin trial going on, she needed an out. And by being on the camera, on yelling, taser, taser, it sounds like I got a taser in my hand. I'm announcing that I have a taser. And that's what I do. I don't think that she felt she had a taser in her hand. I think that the incident blew out of proportion, and so she shot the man, you know. And I want to make a point on George Floyd, too, after this one. But that is my feeling on that one, Tom. On the Floyd thing, here's my question. If I'm not mistaken, Chauvin is the defendant, unless I'm mistaken. So
not today.
Why?
Yeah, apparently, the new strategy for the defense is to make George Floyd the defendant.
And that's my point. That's my point, Tom. Why is it that when the prosecution wanted to bring up Chauvin's past transgressions, the judge would not allow them to do it? Now, this man is the defendant. But now they're going to do everything they can, bringing up Floyd's past transgressions. And is the I haven't started watching the trial yet, but if the judge is allowing this to happen, my question is why, considering the fact that the defendant is Chauvin and not Floyd.
Well, part of it is that this is the way they've always done it. You know, when a cop kills someone, you've got to start parading every last terrible thing about that person's life. You know, even small mistakes out in front of the jury to justify the cop killing them. So this is always the way they've always done it. I didn't watch enough of it today. So I can't tell you exactly. What I did watch was very clearly the defense lawyer trying to put George Floyd on trial, which is, you know, an old strategy. The question, I guess, the larger question, James, is whether this strategy is still going to work or whether its day has passed. And I'm inclined to think its day has passed, but we'll find out. James, I got to move along, but thank you for the call. Carol in Manassas, Pennsylvania. Hey, Carol, what's up?
Hi, Tom. In regard to the Dante Wright killing, I have a question that's been puzzling me right along. When I first saw the video, a very large cop was handcuffing Mr. Wright, and Mr. Wright looked like a very slightly built man. And then I assume he was put in the car after he was handcuffed. And my concern and my question is, why did she run in and feel the need to tase a handcuffed man sitting in his car? A handcuff. Why would you even want to tase him? And why didn't she let that officer that did the original arrest take over after he handcuffed him? Why did she come running in?
I don't
understand.
There was two cops on either side of him. I don't understand it either, Carolyn. Yeah, and the other two cops seemed like they had it under control. Yes, he kind of fell back into the chair, into the seat after he was handcuffed, but he was friggin' handcuffed. I mean, what are you going to do at that point?
Yeah. Why would she feel the need to tase him at all?
Right. I don't get it either. And in fact, the police manual says that you don't tase somebody when they're sitting in the driver's seat of a car because the car might lurch off, which, by the way, is exactly what happened.
Yeah.
Carol, thank you. Thank you for the call. Yep. It's talk media for the sane among us, the Tom Harbin program. We'll be back with more of your calls right after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Our book today in the Tom Hartman Book Club is Ezra Klein's new book, Why We're Polarized. This is from the introduction, and it's a couple pages into it. I'm starting out here. I have found that American politics is best understood by braiding two forms of knowledge that are often left separate. The direct on-the-ground insights shared by politicians, activists, government officials, and other subjects of my reporting, and the more systemic analyses conducted by political scientists, sociologists, historians, and others with the time, methods, and expertise to study American politics at scale. On their own, political actors often ignore the incentives shaping their decisions, and academic researchers miss the human motivations that drive political decision-making. Together, however, they shine bright light on how and why American politics works the way it does. There's much awry in American politics, and I won't in this book attempt to catalog all of it. But I've come to believe the master story, the one that drives almost all divides and most fundamentally shapes the behavior of participants, is the logic of polarization. That logic, put simply, is this. To appeal to a more polarized public, political institutions and political actors behave in more polarized ways. As political institutions and actors become more polarized, they further polarize the public. This sets off a feedback cycle. To appeal to a yet more polarized public, institutions must polarize further. When faced with yet more polarized institutions, the public polarizes further, and so on. Understanding that we exist in relationship with our political institutions, that they are changed by us and we are changed by them, is the key to this story. We don't just use politics for our own ends. Politics uses us for its own ends. There are many different types of polarization possible, and I'll discuss some of them later in the book, but the locus of polarization I'll discuss is on political identity. And that requires saying a few words about a term that should be very useful in American politics, but that has become almost useless: identity politics. A core argument of this book is that everyone engaged in American politics is engaged in identity politics. This is not an insult, and it's not controversial. We form and fold identities constantly, naturally. Identity is present in politics in the way gravity, evolution, or cognition is present in politics. That is to say, it is omnipresent in politics because it is omnipresent in us. There is no way to read the literature on how humans form and protect their personal and group identities. Literature I will survey in this book, and believe that any of us is immune. It runs so deep in our psyches, so activated so easily by even weak cues and distant threats, that it is impossible to speak seriously about how we engage with one another without discussing how our identities shape that engagement. Unfortunately, the term identity politics has been weaponized. It is most often used by speakers to describe politics as practiced by members of historically marginalized groups. If you're black and you're worried about police brutality, that's identity politics. If you're a woman and you're worried about the male-female pay gap, that's identity politics. But if you're a rural gun owner decrying universal background checks as tyranny, or a billionaire CEO complaining that high tax rates demonize success, or a Christian insisting on nativity scenes in public squares, well, that's just good old-fashioned politics. With a quick sleight of hand, identity becomes something that only marginalized groups have. The term identity politics in this usage obscures rather than illuminates. It's used to diminish and discredit the concerns of weaker groups by making them look self-interested. Special pleading in order to clear the agenda for the concerns of stronger groups, which are framed as more rational, proper topics for normal political debate. But in wielding identity as a blade, we have lost it as a lens, blinding ourselves in a bid for political advantage. We're left searching in vain for what we refuse to allow ourselves to see. All politics is influenced by identity. Those identities are most powerful when they are so pervasive as to be either invisible or uncontroversial. American is an identity. So too is Christian. When politicians, including the irreligious, end speeches with "God bless America," it's not because they're making an appeal to a higher power, but because they're making an appeal to our bedrock identities. If you don't believe me, ask yourself why there are so few open atheists or even agnostics in national politics. This does not mean that politics is an equation solved by locating identity. Identity shapes our worldview, but it does not mechanistically decide it. And while we often speak of identity as a singular, it is always a dizzying plural. We have countless identities, some of them in active conflict with each other, others lying dormant until activated by threat or fortune. Much that happens in political campaigns is best understood as a struggle over which identities voters will inhabit come election day. Will they feel like workers exploited by their bosses or heartlanders dismissed by coastal elites? Will they vote as patriotic traditionalists offended by NFL players who kneel during the national anthem, or as parents worried about the climate their children will inhabit? What we are often fighting over in American politics is group identity and status. Fights that express themselves in debates over policy and power, but cannot be truly reconciled by either. Health policy is positive sum, but identity conflict is zero sum. The book Why We're Polarized by Ezra Klein.
Kevin in Terre Haute, Indiana. Hey, Kevin, what's up?
Hey, this is about the police shootings. I think that in every county in America, the police, the sheriff, and any of the state police in that county, if there's a shooting, they ought to have to put in a pool $1,000 each time there's a shooting, and out of their income, they lose that money, and they can't have, like, no police donations for that money. You know, this way, you force the police agencies to police themselves. If there's a shooting, if it's justified or something like that, there would still be some amount of limit that each one of them would lose, because look, if you are shooting people, there's a problem, you know, and even if it's justified, you still have to have some repentance for the public. If you have people that cops can shoot people, you ought to have a pool where if I'm going to lose money in this pool, I'm a police officer, then I'm going to, after a couple of shootings, I want to have everybody there that this is the procedures that we are going to abide by, because I'm not willing to lose my money or my family's money because of reckless shootings of other officers. And, you know, yeah. Let the police, police themselves.
Kevin, I get it. Let me just toss an idea out to you. You know, the whole $1,000 in fees and, you know, it's almost too much like, well, if you kill somebody, this is what it's going to cost you. Why not treat cops like we do doctors? You know, doctors hold your life in their hands. They can kill you with a scalpel just as easily as they can heal you. And sometimes they do kill people. And what we do is we say, if a doctor kills you, you can sue that doctor. You can take him for everything he's got. You can wipe him out for the rest of his life. Or he can buy malpractice insurance. But hey, if he's been sued, he's not going to easily find that malpractice insurance in the future. Why not just do that? Why not just do away with this whole qualified immunity thing?
Well, they shouldn't have immunity because the police never grant, or the state legislatures never grant us immunity. You know, I live in Terre Haute, and our biggest thing that we built now is a jail in order to conduct state legislature's law. And state legislatures has all the power over all the police agencies. And if we hold the police agencies responsible for their actions, you know, we should also hold the state legislature responsible for their action. You know, here's an idea, Tom. why not have, like I like call this, the Kevin Law, where if for 5 years, each law that a state legislature passes, you have to have improvements each year. And at the end of the 5 years, if they haven't made vast improvements, then that law after 5 years cannot be a law. It's kind of like like a pilot program.
Yeah, yeah. Well, a lot of that's going to depend on state constitutions and things like that, Kevin, but it seems like, just a straightforward, if you want accountability, holding individuals accountable seems like a good place to start. Kevin, great rant. Thank you very much for the call. Dennis in Sarasota, Florida. Hey, Dennis, thanks for listening to WMNF. You had some thoughts on this. It says here you're a retired trial attorney who used to try cases against the police.
That's true, Tom, and good afternoon. Qualified immunity doesn't prohibit civil actions against law enforcement officers. I've brought at least a half a dozen to a dozen myself. It does not prevent you from suing cops for doing obviously wrong things. The qualification, as I recall it, and it's been a while since I researched it, but more in a general statement, if the act in question has never been adjudicated by a court before as being a violation of civil rights, then basically it's one free bite at the apple. But I've never really seen one in my practice. The usual lawsuits for excessive force, false arrest, false imprisonment are routinely filed. So it's not really an impediment to an action against law enforcement officers. And the usual vehicle for bringing the suit is the 1866 Civil Rights Act. It's now codified in 42 U.S.C. Section 1983, which makes any person acting under a color of state law who deprives a person of constitutional rights is subject to an action for damages, as well as for payment of attorney's fees to the plaintiff's attorney. You get a jury trial in a federal court, which is the best place to bring these, because then you don't have people worrying about their local taxes going up. Myself, I would file civil rights actions against law enforcement up in Tampa so as to avoid Sarasota and Bradenton juries, because I'd be suing a Sarasota or a Bradenton deputy or a police officer. So it's not really a high hurdle.
So you are...
It doesn't really exist for most cases.
So it is possible to sue police officers. What are your thoughts... number one, how often that's successful. Number two, whether or not police officers should have liability insurance like doctors and nurses, or is that analogy not at all apt? And number three, this whole issue of qualified immunity.
Well, insurance is available, and most agencies have it. It's akin to a malpractice policy. And in state and
for the individual officers or for the local agency?
For the officers and for their own employers. You have vicarious liability of the employer. So actions performed by a law enforcement officer in the line of duty, so to speak, make him or her and the employing agency legally liable if civil rights are violated. So it covers both. And another thing about going into federal court, some states like Florida have a limitation on damages. There is no such limitation in federal court.
So what's the solution? I mean, that's kind of the after the fact best solution is, sue. And certainly people do that and they get, good judgments and settlements. But how do we reform our policing from your point of view as a guy who's, prosecuted cops over the years?
Well, not only did I prosecute,
is that not the problem?
An informal advisor to the Manatee Sheriff's Department after we ran off a bad sheriff and got a good one. The lawyers who were handling these sorts of suits, because I wasn't the only one. There were several other firms. But we literally ran a corrupt sheriff out of office. And the new sheriff who ran against the corrupt sheriff was a college professor of law enforcement. And he was a great sheriff. So I would be consulted by one of his senior staff as to what I thought about this, that, or the other thing. And with respect to law enforcement officers, you have to remember that it's not the easiest job in the world. It's not the toughest. As I understand it, firefighters have a more dangerous job than law enforcement officers. But nonetheless, it is somewhat stressful. So you have to understand that if they're out there every day, and if they're in a, South Central L.A., for example, or the south side of Chicago, where there's a lot of conflict, these officers need a lot of support, and I recommended that they have a staff psychologist on there to deal with the traumatic stress that officers can be confronted with, so they don't become PTSD cases and thereby getting a little crazy on the street every now and then. So you want to recognize the difficulties. Yeah. Then you also want to, if I was in charge, I would give every applicant a Myers-Briggs or a Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Index test to find out their personality profiles and see if they had any psychological or psychiatric disorders that would preclude them from withstanding the stresses of being out on the street every day. So pick a good officer, support right. them, and make sure you don't let nut jobs in.
Yeah, I'm with you. Dennis, I got to move along, but thank you. Thanks so much for the benefit of your experience and the insights you offer. I really appreciate it.
Okay,
thank you.
You're welcome.
And great talking with you. Grant in Ventura, California. Hey, Grant, what's up?
Tom, I'd like to talk about law enforcement's problem with steroid use. As high as 1 in 5 police are on steroids. They even have police seminars about the steroidal epidemic in law enforcement and the signs the signs and symptoms of steroid use are sleep deprivation, fight-flight syndrome, paranoia, poor impulse control, impulsive violent episodes, to the point where police, 5 times the number of domestic violence incidents are in the police.
Which raises a question, Grant. Is that because people who would be violent in a domestic situation are drawn to policing, or because people who are within policing are exposed to so much violence and such a violent culture that they're more likely to go home and beat up their family?
They've shown that steroid use just intensifies all that, and a lot of the police are on steroids. And so when you see these traffic stops escalate to violence,
many
are on steroids, but police unions don't ask police the police to normally take drugs, drug tests.
Cops who took down that Army lieutenant, were on. They shouldn't be. We need to get control of that. Gar in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Gar, what's on your mind today?
Oh, how you doing there, Tom? Been listening to you for a long time. I just like to make a couple points. Policemen used to live in the neighborhood. Now they don't have to live in your neighborhood. That's the biggest problem. When I was growing up, you knew all the policemen by first name, and they knew you. You know, they knew your parents. You know, but now, you know, they bring, the policemen from. They didn't have suburbs then, and almost all. Because I grew up with mostly. A lot of Caucasian, we was all in one neighborhood. Then the suburbs came, and then everything changed. But I want to talk a little bit about the mud seal theory. I know you know a little bit about that. James Henry Hammond, that we need a lower class.
You're talking from the 19th century, from the 1800s?
Right. And this is what's going on today.
Okay.
And the mud seal theory is that we must have a lower class for the upper class to rest on. And that's what's going on with the policemen.
Right.
They want to keep a lower class. Okay, like last week, Black Lives Matter protested against a Caucasian killed in Lansing, Michigan, just like George Floyd. This was in Lansing, Michigan. And Black Lives, you didn't hear nothing about that. You didn't hear nothing about that because they don't want blacks and poor and working whites to come together. That's why you didn't hear nothing about that.
Sure. That was Martin Luther King's big crime.
Yeah, and to me, that's the problem. I mean, Black Lives Matter marched for this Caucasian killed by the police, but nobody, no news coverage of it. None.
Yeah.
And I think it's because they want that mud seal theory. They want that lower class for the upper class to rest on. Okay, look up the mud seal theory by James Henry Hammond, and you should read it one day. Thank you.
Yeah. Got it. Thank you, Gar. Ted in Hatsboro, Pennsylvania. Hey, Ted, what's up?
Hi, Tom. This is first time caller, and this is I've tried to get to you 3 times. This is the first third time. I wanted to tell you that there were things that really bothered me. I went to a gun store one time, and I was buying guns, and I told them that when you buy a gun, you should have responsibility for the gun. And the guy that's selling me the gun looked at me like I had 2 heads. I said, my responsibility.
Yeah, we're selling toys here.
It was selling toys. I looked at him like he had two heads, like, hey, look, my responsibility of owning a gun is to keep you, so keep you just so you can still have it. And you go around here selling guns to guys that want to shoot anything that moves.
Yeah. Yeah.
Are they
yeah.
out of their
it's
mind?
Unfortunate.
And then they don't want their guns taken away, and then they trash the doggone Capitol building. What kind of crap is that? What do you expect people to do? I said, yeah. You know, if you don't want nothing to happen, don't do anything to cause it.
Yeah, I'm with you, Ted. I'm absolutely with you. Thank you for the call. Rudy in Atlanta. Hey, Rudy, your thoughts?
Well, Tom, you and I have been talking about racism for a while.
Yep.
If we don't watch it, if the grown-ups in the room, if there are any more grown-ups in the room, racism is going to take this country down. I think Putin and the other world leaders, they understand what racism has done to this country. But anyway, Tom, enjoy your show, man. I love you. Take care, all right?
Well, thank you, Rudy. Yeah, I think, you know, Rudy, I would say, you know, you say racism's going to take this country down. I would go so far as to say racism has held this country back. You know, 400 years of racism has held this country back. By the middle of the 1800s, as the Southern Confederacy had risen up and turned the South into an absolute police state for people of all races, but in particular, obviously, for black people, by that period of time, the northeastern part of the United States had the Wright brothers. I think it was right around that time. You had industrialization. You had the railroads going coast to coast. America was moving forward. You know, we were right on the cusp of Thomas Edison and all his inventions, steel, rail, oil, all, you know, inventions like crazy, industrialization. None of that was happening in the South. The South was still essentially a third world country. And to a large extent still is, if you use metrics like, you know, infant mortality or maternal death or, you know, hookworm infection or ringworm infection. I mean, it's just, well, we will be back. Pick up more of your phone calls on the other side of these breaks. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Speaking the truth, the multinational corporations, we're really ready to know all about. Tom Hartman here with you. We'll be right back.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait till you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.
Our book today is How to Be Less Stupid About Race by Crystal M. Fleming. This is from the introduction, The Origins of Racial Stupidity. It opens with an epigraph from Martin Luther King Jr. It is an aspect of their sense of superiority that the white people of America believe they have so little to learn. From the introduction. Hundreds of years after establishing a nation on colonial genocide and chattel slavery, people are kind of, sort of, maybe, possibly waking up to the sad reality that our racial politics are still garbage. But as our society increasingly confronts the social realities of race, we're faced with a barrage of confusing developments. How could the same country that voted twice for an Ivy League educated black president, end up electing an overt racist who can barely string together two coherent sentences? Why do white liberals who can't even confront their Trump supporting friends and families think that they can lead the resistance? Democrats who don't care about mass deportations or the treatment of Muslims under Obama suddenly care now that a Republican is in charge. While black and brown people are being crushed by systemic white supremacy, the rapper Common thinks we can all get over a race by extending a hand in love. Don Lemon still has a job. Rachel Dolezal exists. Everyone has an opinion about race, but 99% of the population has never studied it. And even many textbooks that talk about race are filled with lies, inaccuracies, and so-called alternative facts. With so much racial ignorance in the world, how can we ever find our way to that glorious mountaintop Martin Luther King Jr. glimpsed right before a white racist killed him? Although race is an inherently divisive topic, the cause of continual controversy, Facebook feuds, and endless debates, there is exactly one thing and one thing only that we can probably all touch and agree on, regardless of our racial or ethnic identity, gender, age, political beliefs, or shoe size. And that is that we are surrounded by racial stupidity. From the White House to Waffle House, from the classroom to the internet comments section, from the television to the tiki torch aisle of your local Pier 1, we are surrounded and at times astounded by the ignorant and dangerous ideas people express about this thing called race. Why are so many people so incredibly confused and misinformed about race? It's the white supremacy, stupid. As I'll demonstrate throughout this book, one of the main consequences of centuries of racism is that we are all systemically exposed to racial stupidity and racist beliefs that warp our understandings of society, history, and ourselves. In other words, living in a racist society socializes us to be stupid about race. Of course, as you well know, some people are more afflicted by racial stupidity than others. We'll get into the nature of those variations a bit later. For now, I want to emphasize just how widespread and ubiquitous racial ignorance really is. Politicians routinely spout racist distortions of reality and lie about the existence and nature of racial oppression. Absurd racial stereotypes pervade our various forms of media. And as noted, textbooks systemically misrepresent racial history in ways that minimize or erase racism altogether. And all too often, teachers themselves are undereducated or miseducated about the history and ongoing realities of racial oppression. How to Be Less Stupid About Race explores precisely how and why racial stupidity has become so terribly pervasive, and examines the cesspool of silly ideas, half-truths, and ridiculous misperceptions that have thoroughly corrupted the way race and racism are represented in the classroom, pop culture, media, and politics. The key idea that I'll come back to again and again is that living in a racist society exposes us all to absurd and actually harmful ideas that in turn help maintain the racial status quo. Drawing from my own experience as an educator and as someone who continually confronts my own racial ignorance, I'll also share some concrete steps that you, as well as your racist friends, ignorant family members, and clueless coworkers, can take to become less stupid about race and better equipped to detect and dismantle racial oppression. While I don't personally believe in post-racial utopias, and I don't put a lot of faith in reaching glorious mountaintops, I know for sure that the very first step in challenging racism is having a clear understanding of what it actually is. Not only are we surrounded by stupid ideas about race, we are even surrounded by stupid ideas about how to talk about race. In May 2015, Starbucks launched a doomed campaign called Race Together to encourage baristas and coffee drinkers around the country to have a conversation about race. Although many might have mistaken the campaign for a satirical entry on The Onion, Starbucks announced that its employees had the option of arbitrarily writing the hashtag Race Together on a random customer's cup. Aspiring coffee drinkers minding their own damn business would then be obliged to say something to the barista about race. After a steady stream of criticism and mockery on social media by anti-racists across the color spectrum, yours truly included, the company eventually backpedaled and canceled the initiative. To some, encouraging random people to talk about race sounds like a step in the right direction. But we don't need more profit-driven corporations to take a stand and say that race is a legitimate and important topic of discussion. Rather than thinking about the best practices that might foster a productive discussion about race, the company executives thought best to just sort of tell everyone to figure it out without providing any educational resources, training, or guidelines whatsoever. In a letter to employees, Starbucks chairman Howard Schultz stated that he conceived of the idea, quote, not to point fingers and not because we have answers, but because staying silent is not who we are. How to Be Less Stupid About Race by Crystal Fleming.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Ben in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Ben, you're on the air. What are your thoughts?
You asked, how can we reimagine the police? What does that look like? And I've got a couple of very specific ideas that I think would be impactful right away. The first one should be looked at through the lens of the Stanford Prison Experiment. If you dress somebody up like a badass, they're going to act like a badass. And I think about traveling.
Yeah, for people who don't know what you're talking about, Ben, you might want to encapsulate that that experiment in a couple of sentences.
So the Stanford Prison Experiment was a situation where students were divided into two groups. One was the prisoners, and the other were the prison guards, the keepers. And within a very short time, it degraded into an abusive, bad situation that actually had to be stopped by administration because it was out of hand. And it was out of hand because the people that were the guards were, you know, they were given khaki shirts and khaki pants and mirrored sunglasses, and wow, it went straight to their heads, and it got completely out of hand. So my point is that you dress the police like public servants. You make them drive Prius with a big yellow stripe down the middle. They have safety vests on, and you remove all the, how to put this delicately, big dick.
All the military trappings? Yeah.
That's right. And you elevate the concept of being honorable by truly watching out for the public's best interest, not your brother's interest, because the risk comes along with the job. So, obviously, they want to go home at night. I don't have a problem with that, but you don't put your own safety in front of public safety. That's the first big piece. And the second big piece is that it has to be hard to become a cop, and they're much better paid. You take all those resources that are sent to armored vehicles and specialized weaponry and so forth, and you direct it to psychological evaluation, training, that actually impacts their interaction with the public, and it goes on for a year and a half. And what that does is it effectively weeds out all the cops who just want to get in it because it's badass, for the girls, for the guns, for the prestige. And you make it about the honor of public service as opposed to the Camaro with racing wheels and your cool uniform and all the stuff. I mean...
Got it.
That's it, really. You change the culture by changing the mindset, and you make it hard to become a cop so that only truly dedicated public servants, people that are motivated to
serve. I'm completely with you, Ben. And this is, you know, I've said many times on this program, the two people who hold our present and our future, the quality of life and our present and our future in their hands, are the police and our teachers. And we underpay both of them dramatically. And we have very high standards for teachers. We don't generally for cops. And we need to get there. Ben, I love all your ideas. I think that Reagan's 1099 program, the hyper-militarization of the police, was probably one of the major things that set up this situation today and got us where we're at, and it needs to be reversed too. Ben, thank you. Matt in Milwaukee. Hey, Matt, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Long time I haven't called you, and I love to talk to you.
Thank you.
Thank you for taking my call. But I wanted to get to the point is people who have not asked black people, like maybe they don't have a black friend, they don't have interactions with black people. I'm from Phoenix. I moved out here to Milwaukee. And I didn't know as many black people. And when after that happened with George Floyd, I started seeing video after video on YouTube of different scenarios where they are obviously racially profiling. They obviously overreact and they go to their gun when that first thing, and they have them get step out of the car for nothing. And I thought about all the times I've been pulled over, and I'm scared of the cops too. You know, I was young, but I never had a cop pull a gun on me, ever. And you see the George Floyd
one,
that was the first thing they did. And I think people need to understand your interaction with police officers isn't theirs, and they don't understand that. And if we could just go back to having these guys get called out to respond to emergencies instead of on there enforcing all these little minor traffic violations. I mean, they were telling the guy in Virginia that they can just arrest him or they can let this thing go. They're blackmailing him.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Yeah, essentially. Yeah, we don't want to hurt your military career, so let's not talk about this. Yeah. Matt, spot on. And you're absolutely right. The experience, white people who think they understand police don't understand police. Thanks so much for being with us today. We'll be back tomorrow. Same bat time, same bat channel. In the meantime, don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It requires you to participate. So check out indivisible.org and all the other great organizations out there. Check in with your local Democratic Party. Show up. We all have to make this democracy work, this republic work. So tag your it. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a great afternoon. Be good to yourself and the people around you. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit tomhartman.com.